So what should we make of all the recent stock market trading in GameStop? Do the traders or the services they use have any legal liability? Let's get on topic. Welcome to On Topic, a weekly in-depth look at a topic that helps us understand the week's news. My name's Renato Mariotti. I'm a former federal prosecutor, a practicing lawyer, and a legal analyst. And I'm joined by my friend Patty Vasquez, the host of the Patty Vasquez Show, who joins us regularly on this podcast. But before I bring in Patty, I want to thank our patrons who brought us this episode, with special thanks to Andrew Donnelly, James Frohmeyer, Jay Gelhausen, Jamie and Izzy Gordon, Patrick, Angela Jackson, Ari Lamstein, Dan Maruska, Shana Wachinski, and an anonymous patron. You too can become a patron on our website, ontopicpodcast.com. Just click the support link at the top of the page. So, Patty, I've got to say, I actually, in my day job, I spend a lot of time thinking about potential liability for traders and people involved in the stock market in various ways. But it's rarely something that is in the news to quite the extent it is. And let's face it, most of us don't really spend a lot of time thinking about the stock market and that sort of thing all the time, unless you have invested a lot of money in it or you're trading in it in your spare time. But this GameStop stuff has really captured a lot of people's attention this week.
Oh, absolutely. And it was interesting. About a week and a half ago, a friend of mine sent me a link, you know, sort of a referral to this Robinhood app. And he's like, I'm doing really well on this. You should, you know, try it. You get a free stock on me. And, you know, I thought about it, but I really know very little about how to invest. I have a 401k. You know, I kind of keep track of some of my money markets, things like that, but I'm not active. So I wasn't sure. And then this story happened and I was like, there is a part, obviously, of it where a lot of people are excited, like we're sticking it to the hedge fund managers, and you know they buy up companies that are at low prices and they break them up and they, you know, destroy these businesses that were grown by families or people who, you know, just wanted to make a way in life. And then you also have the, you know, how disruptive and the fact that Robinhood suspended trading, all of it just really amplifies that there needs to be better safeguards in place for our stock market.
Yeah, it's interesting. I will tell you a few things. First of all, I mean, there's often people trying to get other people to trade stocks. That's not unusual. I do think that the social component of this was fascinating. Like you said, this idea that somehow this is you're engaged in social justice by trading a particular stock, that's definitely rarely the case, right, when people are trying to get you to buy a particular stock. So that was very different here, and it was part of the pitch and part of the appeal. You had a lot of Redditors. I happen to read Reddit a lot of times myself. I have for years. So, you know, it was interesting to see them, all these gamers, and I guess I'd count myself as a gamer as well, all being like, okay, we're going to save GameStop and stick it to the hedge funds, I think they thought they were sticking it to. Very interesting. I mean, one thing I wonder is whether the people who started this wave of investing were more sophisticated and were able to sort of use this to take advantage of a particular wave. And then a lot of other people just got caught up in it. But regardless, as you point out, you know, we generally like the stock market to not be distorted in any way, and for prices to be based on, you know, market information and so forth. And obviously our markets are far from perfect, and there's a lot of, I think, legitimate critique out there about them. But this one was particularly interesting, and it had such a massive impact that I think it certainly captured the popular imagination in a way a lot of other events in the markets have not.
I'm glad that you mentioned that. There's a great story. I don't know if you saw. I mean, look, there's obviously the bigger picture of it that we're all trying to catch up and understand this. But my favorite story out of this is a mom with a young son. He's about 11 or 12 years old. When he was 9, she started teaching him about investing, saving money, how to manage your accounts. And they bought stock in GameStop. and he made, they bought about, I think it was like $200 or $300 worth of games, GameStop, and he now made $3,000. They cashed in, and it was a great little story. And she was like, I wish I bought that. But, you know, she was trying to teach him like, what are you drawn to? What do you think would make a good investment? So that was a really sweet story. You know, so nice for some folks, I hope that they got a nice little bump during this time of crisis.
Yeah, no kidding. When I was that age, I was investing in baseball cards. It didn't work out quite as well. So,
You never found your Hornsby? You never found
clearly, you know, that's the thing. I was investing in newer players than Rogers Hornsby. If I did, I would have been in better shape.
You gotta find your Tris speaker out there somewhere. You know what you really need is an Ed Delahanty. I'm sorry, I could go on and on about old baseball players. Continue.
Clearly. So I definitely think you know, there are some individuals who made money here. There's going to be some winners and losers, and I think, you know, what I think a lot of people are asking about, and I've been getting tons and tons of questions on this. That's the reason we're doing this. Is okay. Are any of these people on Reddit or elsewhere online, are they going to jail? Are they going to get the subpoenas from the SEC? What's going on? You know, the Biden administration has said that the SEC is looking at this. And then separately, you know, people are mad at Robinhood and other services for shutting down trading and saying that's totally unfair and it shows they're in the pocket of somebody or whatever. And, you know, the question I've been getting is, okay, who, you know, is there any liability for them? So I will let all of you know, I do have my own views on this. I was the first prosecutor to prosecute a high frequency trader for a particular type of market manipulation. So I do a lot of work now in private practice, you know, in that trading world. But when it comes to SEC issues, there's a friend of mine who I call all the time to chat about SEC issues, because I deal with those often as well. And he is a former SEC attorney, was for many years, and now he's one of the leading practitioners in the securities enforcement world. His name is Jerome Tomas, and he's a partner at a big law firm called Baker McKenzie. And we spent so much time talking about this and had fun with it, because his son is one of these Redditor gamer folks who wanted to invest very much in GameStop. And so he was kind enough to join us. So I'm going to bring Jerome Tomas in now. Welcome to the podcast, Jerome. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Renato. Glad to be here.
So I think we're going to have to start at the beginning here and assume that there's a lot of folks listening who I think are probably wondering what the heck happened. I mean, they watched the news or read the news and they saw that GameStop shares were skyrocketing in price, but it's not clear why or how that happened. So can you just give us a simple explanation of what was going on there?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, this is really a story about a public company, and really public companies. It's not just GameStop. There are other companies also at issue here. A group of core investors that identified GameStop and others as potential buy targets. Others in the market who took a contrary view, and a market frenzy that's fed by online brokers with low fee structures and, of course, social media. Social media is kind of the game changer here. So real quick, let's talk about the story of GameStop. And this is just an example. Really, the GameStop run-up story appears to go back to a single investor based on reports I've heard and read. So about 2 years ago, an individual, Keith Gill, who's now 34 years old and who has a financial background, decided that he liked long-term prospects of GameStop. He started acquiring shares of or positions in the company stock over that period of time, although at that point the company stock was still trading in the, you know, $5 to $10, maybe even a little under $5 range. Significantly, and I think this is what is different here, he's done what most people under 30-35 do nowadays, is he posted his day-to-day life on social media. So he posted about his stock moves through a Reddit feed called Wall Street Bets. And he also had a YouTube channel and other social media outlets.
Okay, hold on 1 second. So you mentioned, well, first of all, you talked about a buy position and so forth. What do you mean by that? I just want to make sure everyone understands what you're getting.
Yeah. For the folks out there, you know, one way you can buy stock or gain an interest in a company stock is to actually buy a share of the stock. And a share of a stock is an ownership stake in that company. So if you were to buy 100 shares of, say, Apple, you would own 100 shares of Apple. And whatever the total number of shares issued is, let's say it's a million, you would own 100 shares out of a million shares of Apple. So you wouldn't control Apple. You wouldn't control Google by that ownership interest, but you literally would have an ownership interest in the company. When we say positions, that's a little different because, for example, there are things like options, and we'll use options as a great example around here, which is a it is also a security, but you don't buy an ownership interest in the company. What an option is really is a bet, and it's a bet that either the stock price will go up or the stock price will go down. And so depending upon whether you think the price of the stock will go up or the price of the stock will go down, you buy an option that corresponds with what you think where you think the price will go. And you then either gain money or lose money depending upon whether your bet was right or wrong. And so those are what options. So when I use, you know, when I use the term position, I'm largely referring to the potential that it's either stock ownership or it's an option position and an option purchase.
Yeah, an option to buy. And in other words, if the stock price is at 20 now, you may want to have an option to buy it for a similar price or even a maybe slightly higher price in the future if you think the price is going to skyrocket, because then in the future you could exercise that option and then you'd have even more shares. Is that essentially the idea?
Yeah, exactly. So let's walk through an example, Rado. So let's say, I think the easier example for people to understand is what's called a put option. And that's a bet that the stock will go down. So what happens when you think the company's stock will go down is you go to your brokerage firm and your account, you have to be authorized to do options trades. Not everyone, based on their income level, their net worth, and their sophistication, can or should engage in options trading. I think that's sort of SEC regulation 101. But assuming that you are allowed in your account to do options trading, if you think a company's stock will go down, so let's say it's trading at $20 right now, and you think that it will go down, you can do what's called a put option, and you can put the stock to the market theoretically at the today prevailing price of $20, and based on the price of the stock, let's say the stock goes down to $10, and then you close out that position when the price hits $10, you will get $10 in notional profit on that option. And depending how many options you buy, it can be quite an exponential amount of money that you gain, or potentially the option can expire worthless, right? You could spend $1,000 on an option thinking the price will go down. And if the price goes up, you're not going to exercise that option. That happens all the time. You just let it expire worthless. And so when it expires worthless, the thing about options is there's great risk, because you then that option goes away and you've lost your $1,000. Whereas at least if you own the shares of the stock, if you were to have bought the stock, you would still own the company's stock. So you would still own something. In the case of an option, you own nothing if it expires worthless.
And there's also something, a concept called shorting a stock, which is going to be important here. And I know there anyone who's been paying attention to the news reports has heard that term. Can you explain to us what that means?
Yeah. So shorting the stock is a similar concept. And what shorting the stock is that it's a bet that the company stock will go down. And literally what the physical steps are is under SEC rules, you can't simply put in what's called a naked short. You can't enter a short sale trade without somehow having identified shares that you can then take and physically sell short. So you are required to somehow go out into the marketplace and find shares. Oftentimes they are on loan from other brokers or even your broker, and you get those shares on loan. You pay a fee for getting those on loan, and then you actually sell that stock. In theory, that's what you do. You borrow the stock and you then sell it into the marketplace. And so if you think the price is going to go down, and you get the stock and it's trading at, say, again, $20 here, you loan the stock, you pay some short fees, some loan fees, and then you just turn around and you sell the stock into the marketplace at the market, let's say it's 20. In a short sale, though, you have to what's called cover. What does cover mean? Cover means you have to go out and then actually buy that stock back to repay your loan. So that's where shorting comes in, and that's where the short squeeze concept comes in. A short position can only be profitable if you can go out and buy the stock at a lower price than what you sold it for. If you have to buy the stock for a price higher at what you sold it for, you are going to lose money and potentially lose a lot of money. You can't let a short position expire worthless. That's the thing. In an option, you can. In a short position, you are obligated to cover. So if that price goes through the roof relative to what you sold it to, you are going to have to go out and find that stock and pay whatever it is the market is calling for that stock to then literally take that stock and return it to its rightful owner.
Yeah. So essentially you're trying to sell high and buy low, so to speak. If you sell, end up selling low, and buy high, then you end up losing a heck of a lot of money.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I know Patty has got a question that she had about some of the basics here that is important. Patty, what's that question?
Right. I mean, a lot of folks, obviously are aware that there are trading apps out there like Robinhood or E-Trade. What can you tell us about them and their role in our markets?
So the those apps, and you know, let's just take a step back. The app is the way that you access that firm. But the apps are really set up by what we call in the securities world, broker dealers. And so broker dealers are firms that are regulated by the United States Securities and Exchange Commission. And they are typically the manner by which, in particular, retail investors are able to buy and sell stock. I have my own account at TD Ameritrade that I buy and sell the stock occasionally in. And now I can do that on my computer, or I can do it on my phone through the TD Ameritrade app. And so you mentioned TD Ameritrade. There's also E-Trade. You also mentioned Robinhood. So Robinhood, TD Ameritrade, and the others are broker dealers. They are companies that are in the business of affecting or helping people buy and sell securities. Basically, right? It's very hard for me to go and find shares of, say, Apple. They wanted to buy shares of Apple. I would have to go somewhere and find someone who would be able to sell me their shares of Apple somehow. If they had proof that they own the shares, we would then do the sort of the contractual exchange of those shares. That's incredibly, incredibly complicated and frankly worth no one's time. So what broker dealers do is they operate on a stock exchange, and they operate on multiple stock exchanges, NASDAQ, New York Stock Exchange, stock exchanges around the world. And they have a relationship with their customers where the customer says, I want to buy 100 shares of this company. And the broker says, okay, fine, we will charge you a fee to go out and find that stock. We'll buy that stock for you, and you will hold it in your account here. And that account will be subject to SEC and self-regulatory organization rules and regulations regarding protections of the funds and those assets and what the broker-dealer can and can't do. But essentially, when you're hearing about these apps, they are literally middlemen, broker-dealers, who help individuals buy and sell securities, including, in this case, AMC and GameStop.
And I think it's fair to say, Jerome, that these apps have popularized and lowered the barrier of entry for people to start trading stocks on their own. In other words, years ago, it may be the case, you know, certainly there were broker-dealers that, you know, people would use if they had access to wealth, and you would make phone calls or you'd visit somebody in person and you would put in trades that you wanted to make. But now, you know, people who are reading Reddit, which is a social media platform, or other social media platforms, can just download an app on their phone, and they have to submit an application and so forth. And once they're accepted, they can start trading, and they can just push some buttons and make stock decisions.
That's absolutely right. You know, I remember not long ago when I was a young boy and I would see my dad in the market. My dad had a stockbroker, but my dad would go see that stockbroker. My dad would go and call that stockbroker and have to place orders through that stockbroker. That stockbroker, which oftentimes was represented by a representative, an individual that he had a relationship with, would give him oftentimes advice on the things you bought and sold. But it was a very cumbersome process. Now, it was still easier than before brokers were in place, but it wasn't easy. Fast forward a generation, I have never used a registered representative to buy or sell a share of stock on my behalf. I've made all shares, purchases, and sales on my own through my own online brokerage account. I pay lower fees. I have greater control over what I buy and sell, when I buy and sell, the timing and all of that. Obviously, I'm purely on my own in making my own buy sell decisions. But I've been sort of, you know, I'm sophisticated enough that I feel like I know what I want to do and what I don't want to do. And frankly, as a lawyer in this space, I don't trade a whole lot of securities to begin with. It's mostly sort of change I find in the cushion between my cushions. A lot of what I have is in my 401k. Or is in mutual funds or college savings funds, but I do have some money in a brokerage account that it is much easier to trade for your sort of run of the mill individual like myself, as opposed to 30 years ago.
Yeah. And I think that's a big difference here. You know, one thing that, you know, people have seen and to kind of go to other conversations we've had in this podcast, there's this democratizing influence of information and the internet. And it has all sorts of impacts, many of which we don't like people storming the Capitol because they've all organized on social media and a bunch of disinformation is spread, perhaps. Here, what you're seeing, I think, in part is a democratization and low barrier to entry and the spread of information on the internet having an impact on the markets.
I when I was at the FTC, I worked in the Internet Enforcement Branch. So I was in the Securities and Exchange Commission. I was one of the lawyers, for those who don't know what that means. I was a lawyer for the Securities and Exchange Commission who was charged with investigating potential wrongdoing, violations of the investment laws, the securities laws, and then running into court and filing either administrative or actions in federal court against those wrongdoers. And I focused on, for a number of years, Internet-based securities fraud. I will tell you, Renato, what I saw back then in the early 2000s, it is not different. It's not different in kind of the broad strokes from what we're seeing today. There were AOL and Yahoo chat rooms, and people were talking in those AOL and Yahoo chat rooms back then. I know because I saw them, right? And it was the same type of thing that we're seeing now. The people in those chat rooms were sort of, as they were called, fanboys, right? They were fanboys of the stock, and they were grousing and upset about the shorts, about others who were perhaps unfairly, or in their view, unfairly taking a short position in the stock and engaging in conduct that was driving down the price of an otherwise valuable company. I saw that with my own two eyes. I investigated those types of matters at the SEC. That sounds incredibly similar to what we have here. The difference is, this is back then, social media or these Yahoo chat rooms were kind of a specialized area in the world. Now social media is everywhere. It's a part of everyone's life. I'm a 47-year-old lawyer at a corporate law firm, and I use social media probably more than I did 10 years ago, because it's just such an important part of what we have to do to communicate with the outside world. So I agree, social media has changed this. And frankly, I think if I could sort of editorialize a little bit, I think the social media aspect of this and who is more sophisticated at social media, me or my children? My children 10 times out of 10. We've seen that. We've seen the people who are more sophisticated with a way of communicating and a way of organizing catch essentially their parents by surprise. I do think this is a wake-up call. I also think this might be the first time ever in the recorded history of human beings that children have brought to their parents a profitable investment. Think about that. Right. I mean, I know from my friends telling me that it was their sons, their daughters, walked down the stairs and said, "Mom, Dad, I want to buy 50 shares of AMC. I want to buy 50 shares of GameStop because this is what's going on, and I think I can make money." And I'll tell you what, those boys and girls bought the shares, and probably only 20% of the times it was the parents that bought the shares. So, and my son was the same way. My son came to me on Thursday and said, "Dad, I want to buy AMC." And then I kind of walked him through, well, we got to think about this. It's not as easy for me to do this as it might be for some other people. But then he showed me his analysis, and he was getting analysis from Discord chat on the internet. Right?
I'm on Discord chat. Not about stock trades, though. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. So look, this is I do think this has changed. Now, what the long-term effects are going to be, and was this a blip, or was it something that, invariably changes the way the securities markets are going? I don't think it was a blip. I think this is going to happen again. I think the roadmap has been drawn. Now, how much it changes the way that the market works, I think remains to be seen. I think we also have to see how the regulators respond, right? Because I think right now the regulators are sort of, it's like whack-a-mole. There are so many issues that the regulators have to think about and are thinking about from so many different angles that may or may not change based on new laws, new regulations, enforcement by regulation, right? Maybe there isn't a law on the books, but maybe the SEC and the Department of Justice and other law enforcement agencies take the view that we are going to enforce the anti-fraud provisions or the anti-manipulation provisions of the Exchange Act, which are in Section 9 of the Exchange Act. We're going to enforce them in a way that sends a message to the market that certain conduct that we saw over the past week or two is not permissible. It is not okay under the SEC's views of the securities law. I think that all remains to be seen.
Well, I want to turn back to that in a second, but I know we had a question from a listener that I wanted to get to first. Patty, do you have that?
I do. How is what the Redditors did or are doing any different than what Elon Musk has done with Tesla in the past, with the Tesla shorts in the past? It's a group of people instead of one man, but buying a bunch of stock to drive up the price is nothing new.
So it's a great question. So let's talk sort of in the abstract here, right? So a single person buying stock, for the purpose of buying stock is not illegal, nor is the 100 different people buying stock for the sole purpose of buying stock illegal. Where you, I think, run into issues here that at least the SEC is going to be looking at is this concept of, was there a concerted effort to somehow engage in price manipulation. And again, there are some high barriers that the SEC will need to meet in order to prove that retail traders engaged in price manipulation. But the difference is from sort of a pure, if you're looking at it from an enforcement perspective, when you have a number of people who are banding together to engage in concerted effort, it's something that I think at the very least the SEC is going to want to say, well, what is our view on this kind of activity? People banding together and doing this, a bull raid, if the bill has been called, because we need to know how we're going to deal with in the future. Because I will tell you, it's going to happen in the future. And the SEC is going to need to have a better way of dealing with it than they currently have. It kind of, the SEC has traditionally pursued statement-based fraud and statement-based manipulations, for example, pump and dumps, right? The SEC pursues pump and dumps all the time, but a pump and dump is affected by somebody making a false statement into the market for the purpose of driving the stock up. And then when that stock is going up, they are selling into it. And when market realized that the information was false, the market crashes. However, the manipulator was able to profit on the stock price spike and selling into that. There's the reverse of that, which is someone putting false information to the market that the company is doing poorly, right? That's the story. That's what my partner will call the short and distort. And so you can do that. But again, that's all premised on false information. What we have here is something I think that still is yet to be seen. To what extent are there false statements out there? Are there false statements that were made with a level of state of mind required and that were material enough, that were important enough, that people thought significantly altered the full amount of information out there in the marketplace? So if there was that kind of statement, okay, there might be something that the regulators would want to pursue from a statement-based fraud standpoint. However, if you don't have that, you're going to typically be left with what is traditionally called a price manipulation type case. And those are ones that the SEC in particular has brought with far less regularity because there are specific intent requirements for proving why somebody engaged in a particular transaction. Did they engage in the transaction simply to cause somebody else to have to do a transaction that would lose money? Or because that could potentially be manipulation if your sole purpose was to do a transaction to increase the price to cause somebody else then to have to essentially get out of a position at a loss. The SEC could look at that technically as a manipulation. The problem is you have to show that the seller did, or the manipulator did that with a specific intent to cause that person that price to go up and to cause that person to have to get out of the market. If you are buying a company stock knowing it's going up because you think the company is good, and one of the collateral consequences is that the shorts might lose their shorts, to speak colloquially, that's a much harder case for the SEC to govern and regulate, in particular from an enforcement perspective.
Yeah, and I think it's important to distinguish between these two things. So, you know, the first thing you're talking about is essentially, and I think it's possible it happened here. I think it's not reflected in the reports that we've seen publicly so far, which is that, in other words, essentially what I've read in public reports is there's people saying, hey, you know, GameStop is being shorted by all these big Wall Street firms. That's wrong. They've got it wrong. GameStop's actually going to do very well. And let's stick it to these Wall Street, you know, jerks and buy GameStop and make it go up. And it's going to have two fantastic consequences. We're going to make money because GameStop's a great company. And we're going to stick it to the Wall Street guys who are a bunch of, you know, assholes, essentially. Sorry if your kids are listening.
Yeah, Renato, exactly. So that's a perfect example of something that would not be actionable.
Right.
Because it's a pure statement of opinion, and opinions aren't actionable as misstatements or manipulation.
Right. It's got to be a false factual statement. Exactly.
Now let me give you an example of something I saw with my own two eyes that might be a little different. And it was on a Discord chat on Friday morning that my son sent to me, and it was words to the effect of, "Hey, we need to keep the stock above 10 because at 10, for this is for, I think this was for AMC. We need to keep the stock above 10 because if the stock stays above 10, the shorts are going to have to liquidate at a loss. They're going to lose money. So keep the buying pressure up, keep it up, keep it up." You know, that's where I sort of sat my son down. I'm like, "Oh, time out. You know, this is not purely what I do call fanboy buying because I like the company stock. This isn't hyping a company stock because I like the company. There's another motive here, and it was pretty clearly stated. Now, whether that is a true, whether that rises to the level of manipulation under the federal securities laws, Renato, is something that I think is open for debate. And frankly, how you actually go about enforcing these laws against the myriad people who were sending these messages out and buying the stock based on that theory, you know, for $1,000. I mean, the SEC would be here until next decade bringing these cases. So I do think there's some legal and there are also some practical limitations here. But I also do think that there are things that have been said in the marketplace that are less pure statements of optimism. We love this company stock and let's stick it to the shorts, and more of a, hey guys, we need to do this because we need to stick it to the shorts. And if you understand those, the difference between those two, it could be significant from a legal perspective.
Yeah, it could have a significance. I will say I am a skeptic. As somebody who's manipulation is something that's really in my strike zone in terms of what I've done in the government and in private practice. I think those are just very difficult cases to make. I look forward to representing. So if they're foolish enough to bring one, I would love to be representing the person on the other side of that one. I think it's just a tough game to make these sort of trade-based manipulation cases. But yeah, you do have that intent element. I think it's tough. I will say one of the things that I do find interesting here is that, look, as somebody who's practiced a lot in this space, you don't see a lot of people who have a social justice element to their trading. People are mostly have a dollars and cents element. So one thing I find interesting here is people believing that they are making the world a better place in an activism sense by buying GameStop or AMC or something else.
So I think you hit the nail on the head. Very few things today can bring Representative Ocasio-Cortez and Senator Ted Cruz together like this, as we've seen. And sort of not to get into politics, but to go sort of more close to home. I was out on Friday night with some friends of multiple different political, professional, experiential standpoints. I spoke with a lot of people about this, and they obviously come up to me and ask me what they have to say. And what I found surprising was almost unanimously, no matter whether this person is liberal, conservative, Republican, Democrat, wealthy, straight up middle class, in between, you know, sort of on the trek up through the income ladder, almost unanimously, it was, you know what, I don't have a problem with this. And I was surprised by the relative unanimity of the views I heard from people my age, right, who are kind of, you know, that's who this is targeting, right? You know, the sort of the more establishment from the age and from the where you stand and the economy standpoint. I was surprised by how many people said, you know what, I'm fine with this. Good for them. Good for them. And so, I'm not saying that so much as I agree with it or I don't disagree with it, but I do think that the views of the populace are certainly going to impact just where Congress and probably even to a certain extent the SEC falls in deciding to focus enforcement priorities. Again, the SEC is independent. They're not supposed to be driven by politics. It is an independent administrative agency. But I think you'd also be foolish to think that if, you know, the overwhelming majority of the population doesn't have a problem with this, how much are you going to spend in resources prosecuting the people that nobody has a problem with what they did? Interesting times. This was, you know, I will tell anyone who will listen, you know, I remember the first time that I heard the four chords of Smells Like Teen Spirit. I'd never heard anything like that before. It didn't sound right, but it sounded better than anything I've ever heard in my life. And I couldn't quite fit it in my mind. And when I started reading reports of this, I had the same impression. It was, I don't know that I've ever seen anything like this, and I don't know how to make sense of it. But I know that it's going to be a mind riddle to make sense of it. You know, I look at things legally. I try and fit them into, is this fraud? Is this manipulation? Is there some violation of a technical regulation here? I think you can see, not only by our discussion here today, but frankly, by what you're reading in the media, a number of very reasonable, educated minds will differ entirely on, well, is there a potential claim here and who's in the right, who's in the wrong? What should the SEC do? But the fact that there is this kind of sort of it's not so heavy-handed on one side or the other, I think suggests that this is something that that the markets and the regulators are going to have to struggle with to figure out, how do you strike the right balance and how do you prevent this again, if you think you should prevent it again, right? That's the other thing, Renato. Should this be stopped from happening again? I think if you put 20 reasonable-minded people in a room, you would get 10 different answers.
I think that's right. And I will just say, you know, I initially didn't comment on this development, and I comment often on legal developments because you know, the facts really matter. Then there's very, you know, there's, and I know so much about this area of law that, it, you know, some of the details are important, but it's, and I do agree with you. I think this is an event that'll have an impact, you know, but before we get to sort of how the SEC might handle this, and which I think is an interesting topic, one thing that of course has happened that a lot of people are very interested in, and I know Patty has mentioned that there's been a lot of discussion about, she's gotten questions on this, is Robinhood suspended trading on certain stocks, including GameStop. Can you explain why they did that? And there's been lawsuits that have been filed by traders about this. Can you tell us what's the basis of their lawsuits, and why does Robinhood think they could legally do what they did?
Yeah, so I can't get into the state of mind of Robinhood or its legal advisors, but I think we could speak more generally about what basis a broker dealer, a securities broker, might have to do what we saw. And it wasn't only Robinhood; there were other broker dealers that imposed restrictions on their customers' ability to transact business. In whether it's AMC or GameStop. I just ran into a guy at the grocery store last night who got into a position, but his broker wouldn't let him out of a position. Literally, I had paid for my food, and I was on the way out, and he stopped me and was asking me all about it. So this is happening to real people. And so I think what I would say is, you know, brokers have a number of different obligations under the federal securities laws, under exchange rules. But I think we have to start with the most basic premise, which is there's a contractual relationship between a broker and their client. And that is an account opening agreement, and it has all types of fine print that's drafted by a number of lawyers. But one of the things you will see in those agreements is some clause that says words to the effect of, yeah, we know our business is to allow you to buy and sell stock, and we'll allow you to do so. However, we can place restrictions on your ability to buy and sell stock. And we can do so for legal reasons, for business concern reasons. The firm has pretty much unfettered discretion to impose restrictions on a customer's ability to buy and sell securities. So let's start from that premise that a broker dealer will first sort of point to the account agreement and say, well, we can do this. Going beyond that, they would say, well, look, in addition to the fact that we can do it, the reality is, you know, we have obligations under the federal securities laws to maintain a certain amount of net capital, money in our accounts that makes us a viable broker dealer. But as we transact business for our customers in volatile securities, the other people, the other firms that we are doing business with in those securities, in order to go out and find those securities at these sort of, there are further intermediaries called clearing firms. In order for us to go out and buy the stock through a clearing firm, if the stock is volatile from a price standpoint, we have to give more of a deposit. So we have to send more of our money out the door in a deposit in order to allow you to buy or sell the stock. And that impacts us from a net capital standpoint. And so at some point when the stock gets so volatile and our deposits get so volatile, we physically can't do that or financially can't do that because our desire to want you to do business runs headlong into net capital and clearing firm deposit issues. And we can't go in violation of net capital in order to allow you to buy and sell a volatile security. So that would be sort of another thing that we would be looking at. And I think, frankly, people need to be thinking about in the context of why some broker dealers impose restrictions. The third is suitability, right? So broker dealers have suitability requirements. And so sometimes if it's a, you know, let's say it's a, you know, a 70-year-old pensioner who's, you know, bored at home and decides to, you know, spend half of his or her retirement funds on GameStop or AMC, maybe even options, because they've heard their son or their grandson or granddaughter, whoever, tell them about this, a firm can say, well, stop. There's some suitability requirements here. We don't think you need to be doing this or should be doing this. And frankly, we could get in trouble if we allowed you to do this based on the investment profile and risk that you've described that you're comfortable undertaking. So there are a lot of different reasons why a firm might or could impose restrictions. I think what we've heard on the flip side is, you have a duty to under SEC rules and FINRA rules, which is FINRA is the sort of the self-regulatory organization that oversees all broker dealers in the United States. You have an idea, you have an obligation to use your best efforts to get us to buy or sell the stock we ask for at the price that we direct you to do so. You might not be able to do it, but you have a duty to go out and do that. That's called the duty of best execution. It's an SEC regulation or rule, and it's also in the FINRA rules as well. They are also bringing up theories that, you know, this is just a straight up breach of contract. It's a breach of fiduciary duty. It's negligence, right? You had a duty to execute for us. You breached that duty by not doing that, by not letting us buy or sell the stock. That your failure to do so caused us injury by not letting us buy or sell the stock at the price that we wanted to do so. And then there are allegations of implied warranties of merchantability and of good dealing that I've seen in some of these lawsuits as well. And again, I don't want to comment necessarily because it's so early and the facts of these matters are critical to whether the case has legs or doesn't have legs. But that sort of is what I am seeing based on the things I'm talking to, the people I'm talking to, the things I'm reading, both from the broker dealer side and from the investor side.
We actually had a question from a listener that relates directly to one of the points you made. Patty, do you have that one?
I do. Would Robinhood simply requiring 100% margin on all new and current stock and option trades in highly shorted names have been enough to satisfy their liquidity crunch?
The short answer is I don't have enough information at my disposal to answer that affirmatively. And frankly, I don't know that I would want to answer it in this forum without thinking about it much more closely. I think the reality is that the more money in whatever way Robinhood would have had would have helped them avoid the liquidity crunch. I don't know simply that requiring more margin in and of itself would have been enough. I don't know enough to say yes or no, and I'm frankly not in a position to opine on that. I am always weary, though. Let me just say this. I'm always weary of there being one simple fix to a complex problem. You know, that's something we learned, you know, in law school and even studying for the law school exam. It answers that are always never all or none are always wrong. And I realize there's some inconsistency in that logic, but you know, anyone who's done this long enough knows that complex problems often do not have a one silver bullet answer. And so I'd be shocked if it was that simple, to be honest. But again, I need to look into that a lot more to know whether that would be enough.
Yeah, a lot of folks who listen to the podcast or have read me on Twitter or elsewhere in print or on television, I'll often remark I'm kind of like this wet blanket who's always like, well, it's actually really complicated and there's a lot to this and it may not be quite how it seems, and that's often not the fun answer, but it's the right one. I do wonder though, you know, you were mentioning earlier that, you know, the SEC's, you know, may do something here in response to this. And, you know, what the Biden administration has said, their spokesperson has said essentially that the SEC is looking at this, right? They're looking at this situation. And we know regulators don't like markets that are distorted. They want to try to have markets that don't have volatility that's caused by anything other than, you know, market forces or market information. you know, is this something that we can expect SEC action in? What, just at a high level, what are some of the types of things that we might see the SEC consider?
So, a couple things. I think there are a couple of pretty obvious answers here. One is that the SEC is clearly going to be investigating a number of the facets in this matter. So one would be, was there anything wrong, illegal, about what belongs? And when I say long, I mean the people that bought the stock or bought the options thinking that the price would go up. Those are called long positions. Was there anything wrong with what the long did under the federal securities law? Then that would be, were there any false statements made in the Reddit or Discord chat that were sufficiently egregious enough and material enough to potentially warrant action under the federal securities law? I have my doubts about whether that's a theory that ultimately ends up being the leading edge of what the SEC is looking at or ends up looking at, given just the disparate nature of what happened on Reddit and how many thousands and tens of thousands of posts there were and the small trades potentially. But for example, if it ends up being that there were some false statements made by some people on Reddit or Discord who have a significant position in a long position in Reddit, I could see the SEC kind of tapping the brakes and saying, well, let's look at that a little more. But I think if we're talking about kind of the low level micro $500 and maybe vastly over-optimistic statement bordering on fact or opinion, I don't know that the SEC is going to spend the resources on that. I think that the SEC, on the flip side, is going to be looking very closely at the market response. If you read the commission statement from late last week or late this week, they specifically called out how this was a statement made by the commissioners that the key is market stability and the markets are still functioning in a stable manner. And they want all the market participants to be aware of their obligations under the federal securities laws, kind of the standard boilerplate stuff that you see. But then they also ended by saying, and they are also looking at, and I'm paraphrasing here, practices by broker dealers, which resulted in their customers not being able to enter buy sell orders or buy in securities as they otherwise wanted to. And I think that and obviously there's a lot of speculation, conjecture, et cetera, out in the market about why the firms did what they did, why they shut people down from trading, what was really behind it. I'm not going to get into that. I don't think it's appropriate for us to speculate. But what I can tell you is that given that commission statement yesterday, I think it's highly likely that they look very closely at the relationships between the broker dealers and some of the more established market players who might have had an interest in the stock price not going up as much as it otherwise did, and looking to see if there were any types of relationships there that somehow resulted in a prejudice to the detriment of retail investors. So that is one area that I do think that the SEC will focus on. I think there's the manipulation concept, though, we've talked a little bit about. I think that's – they will look at that. They will need to form a view about what threshold constitutes actionable price-based manipulation. I think they're going to have to wrestle with that. I think, frankly, the SEC has always kind of chose to not deal with that, and that there's a good reason why. These are very hard cases to prove. They're very hard cases to articulate, and reasonable minds will differ about what someone's opinion was and what someone's intent was, why they bought and sold a security. You know that, Renato. So do I. I think this has caught everyone's attention to such a level of magnitude that the SEC is going to have to say something about, was this a manipulation or was this not a manipulation? And a part of this, I think, this is a perfect example for a 21A report of investigation, I think, which is where the SEC doesn't bring enforcement action against a certain group of potential wrongdoers, but instead, after their investigation, they come out with a report on, here's what we investigated, here's what we found, and here is what we think this means from a securities law standpoint, and here is what we are telling the market that it means in the future. Because I think it's particularly well reserved for areas that are novel and are not well worn under the federal securities laws, but are going to be popping up more and more. And so you need to broadcast your intentions to the regulated entities, and frankly to anyone that's governed by the federal securities laws, about where those lines are. Right, there was a famous one that the commission issued a couple years ago on cybersecurity and cybersecurity practices. Again, novel concepts that people aren't sure where the lines were, and the SEC took a very measured approach in not bringing an enforcement action, but instead issuing a report of their investigation and broadcasting their findings to the market. So I think this might be one of those instances where it's well suited for that and not particularly going after all these traders.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. I mean, it's one thing to go, and as you suggested, them taking a close look at broker-dealers. The broker-dealers, the Robin Hoods of the world, they're highly regulated, and they have people on staff whose job it is to make sure that they're complying with the SEC's regulations. And so the SEC can, I think, have very specific, guidance for them in the future that they can anticipate that those broker-dealers are going to have to comply with, or else the SEC is going to find out, what you're going to do about all these random people on the internet. Very different story, as you point out, very difficult cases to put together and to bring. Before we go, I do want to mention, I know that Jerome, you have your own podcast that if any of our listeners, if you love this area and you're excited and interested in learning more about securities enforcement, how these laws work, I know you have a podcast that talks about this. Can you tell us, spend a little bit of time, just tell us about your podcast and where we can find it?
Yeah, no, thanks, Ronald. Yeah, so it's called This Week in Government Enforcement, and it's a podcast that myself and my co-chair of the Baker McKenzie North America Government Enforcement, i.e. White Collar Practice Group at our firm, run. And it's a lot like this. It's a informal discussion, very talksy, very folksy, where we go through enforcement things, topics that we've seen happen that past week. It's sort of the things that you need to know when you walk into the office on Monday morning that happened in SEC enforcement, DOJ enforcement, global white collar enforcement trend. And so again, it can be found if you look online, This Week in Government Enforcement. It's all out there, and you can also feel free, obviously, to email me, and we'd be happy to put you on our email distribution list. I also send around links to it on a weekly basis on my LinkedIn account, and I'm happy to do so for anybody out there. And thank you for letting me plug it, Renato. I appreciate it.
Well, you're welcome. It's something. This is a niche area. It's an area I spend time. Focused on in law. It's not usually what we're talking about here, but I think it's interesting, and it's something that in this particular case is of real relevance to everything that we are discussing about and learning. So thank you so much for joining us, Jerome. Patty, thank you for wading through some kind of complicated questions this week, I would say.
Oh, no, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah, this is a pleasure. Thank you guys for putting it together. Patty, appreciate it. Renato, thank you for the invitation. This is great.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of On Topic. Please subscribe to this podcast, go to your app and review the podcast, and join us for our next episode. I'm Renato Mariotti. Until next time, let's stay on topic.